Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy. This is session number 24, I believe, though I forgot to change the number on my slide. Number 24 of Till We Have Faces. And it is not impossible that we will finish the book tonight. We are within serious range of getting towards the end of the book. So we'll see. We'll see if we get all the way there or not here this evening. Before we begin, I just wanted to remind folks of what our next book is. Next, we will be working on The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. So that's going to be our next book. So if you want, you can go ahead and begin reading. I don't know exactly where we're going to stop, you know, reading to discuss for the first class yet, but anyway, you can begin reading The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, which is our next book that we'll do together. And anyway, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Wanted to remind folks as well about what's coming up next in our moot program. I was just in Houston for another lovely text moot this past weekend, which was very much fun. And our next moot is over in Europe, UK moot. We're going to be in York, England for a moot on the 27th of April. So in just a couple weeks, I will be over in York and really looking forward to that. Of course, as usual, you can join us remotely if you can't make it over to the UK to hang out with us. And then very soon after that, the next weekend, in fact, on May the 4th, we will be in California, in Carlsbad, California, just north of San Diego, for SoCal Moot. That'll be on May the 4th. You might guess what our topic might be. And be connected with for a moot actually being held on May the 4th. Those are our immediately upcoming moots. Not too long after that, 2 weeks after that, we will be in Edmonton for Wild Rose Moot in Edmonton, Alberta. I'm excited. I've never been to Alberta before. So it'll be our second ever Canadian moot in a province I've never visited. So I'm very excited about that. But there we are. So that's what's coming up soon in our moot program. Let us jump back into things. So you will remember that last time we were looking at Orwell and the Fox are in that room with pillars, which is not the pillar room, right? With the pictures on the walls, on three walls of the room, and that fourth open wall with the pillars and the light coming in and the green grass and what looks like water on the other side. Right, not the pillar room, just a pillar room, Jackrabbit, though it does seem uncoincidental that it's a room with pillars at the end of the day. And we were looking at, last time we were focused on the way in which these pictures on the walls parallel and connect Orwell and Psyche. They're the picture of Psyche's labors, as they're depicted in Apuleius. And of course, we should have recognized all three of them, as Orwell herself was in her own visions, probably their visions, connected to all three of them. Began with the suicide attempt, the drowning attempt in the Shenet, which we saw Psyche doing the same thing. And then we saw the scene in which they both were present, though neither one of them really saw the other. That is the episode with the golden rams. Oh, sorry, I skipped the ants. There was the one in which Psyche was assigned to separate out a pile of mixed tiny seeds into individual piles. But she did this easily because she was helped by ants who came and helped her. And of course, we remembered back to the vision in which Orwell had a vision of being an ant, right? That was separating the seeds there. Then we got to the the Golden Rams episode, where remembering in, as we were remembering back to Orwell's experience in that vision when she crossed through the river, that was like the experience of death. And then she got to the other side and wanted to seize the golden locks in order to make herself beautiful. We remembered that that was just after the point at which she was in despair, because she felt that her, not only was her body ugly, but that her soul was, seemed to be ugly too, and that she was not able to beautify her soul any more than she had been able to beautify her body. And in that vision, she felt that if she could only get one piece of the golden fleece of these golden rams, then she would be able to obtain the beauty of the gods. And instead, the rams trampled her, right? They converged upon her in joy and ran her over. And then she just got a glimpse of someone else, right, across the field, who was sort of doing something that she couldn't see, right? Or no, she did see it, that she was collecting golden fleece, and that she was able to collect easily what no amount of effort, what by no amount of effort Orwell was able to obtain. And so, of course, last time we saw the other version of that story, discovering that the other woman was in fact Psyche, and that Psyche was able to achieve her second task once again, because Orwell had done the hard bits and taken the pain and drawn the golden rams to herself. And then of course we got to the third task, which was taking the empty bowl across the desert, going to the source of the river of death, getting the waters of death into the bowl and bringing it back without speaking to anyone else, bringing it back to Ungit so that Ungit could be made beautiful. And we saw in that version of the Psyche vision, there was Orwell walking across the desert with her book in her hand instead of the empty bowl, was almost like superimposed in shadowy form upon Psyche. But where the bird, you know, the eagle of the gods descends and says to Orwell, "You're not the right one," right? And instead, Orwell is hauled off by the shades to go to the trial, where she reads out her book. She goes to the place where her book, where what she's holding in her hands sort of destines her, right? She's brought her complaint against the gods. Psyche, in fact, is carrying an empty bowl, right? And is taken by the eagle, right? The eagle helps her to get the water of death in her bowl, again, without much effort. And then she, goes out. And that's pretty much where we ended it, right in sort of in the middle of the final task of Psyche. But the key thing to remember there is that although it's kind of in the middle of the task, it was at a very important transition point, because that was the point at which Orwell's experience and Psyche's experience no longer ran in parallel, it seemed, but diverged, right? Orwell taken in to have her trial, where she read her complaint against the gods and was answered, the complaint itself being the answer. And then where Psyche now is going on to the completion of the task, right? So now they've gone their separate ways, Psyche and Orwell, in this sort of parallel. And you'll also remember, of course, we were talking about the uncertainty of time. How long ago was it that Psyche tried to commit suicide, for instance? It was quite recent for Orwell. She was, you know, very aged and was going to the river to drown herself because she couldn't even hold her sword anymore, which was how she first wanted to kill herself. But we don't know. We don't know. Was this an image? Was this something that Psyche did a long, long time ago? That was very uncertain, right? Very, very, very unclear. But yes, Leif Nagel, not only was not only is this a really kind of important bifurcation between Orwell and Psyche, but it is marked by the fact that, like, that's what comes to the end of the second wall, right? The rest of what happens with Psyche is in a different place altogether, right? So it's still the third thing, but it's kind of like a later thing, right? So that's where we begin here. The fox: "That's well, daughter, but now be strong and look upon the third wall." We looked and saw Psyche walking alone in a wide way under the earth, a gentle slope, but downwards, always downwards. "This is the last of the tasks that Ungit has set her. She must..." "Then there is a real Ungit?" "All, even Psyche, are born into the house of Ungit, and all must get free from her. Or say that Ungit in each must bear Ungit's son and die in childbed, or change. And now Psyche must go down into the Deadlands to get beauty in a casket from the Queen of the Deadlands, from Death herself, and bring it back to give it to Ungit, so that Ungit will become beautiful. But this is the law for her journey. If for any fear or favor or love or pity she speaks to anyone on the way, then she will never come back to the sunlit lands again. She must keep straight on, in silence, till she stands before the throne of the Queen of Shadows. All's at stake. Now watch." Okay, so let's... Okay, I was going to say, before we... Let's parse that first, but no, wait. Before we do that. Psyche is walking under the earth. Downwards, always downwards. The thing that I would... One of the things that I would point to here, one of the things that I think that we're supposed to be remembering, especially with the fox standing right there, is in this last task, in this last journey that Psyche's taking with the water of death in her bowl in her hands, right? I think she's still carrying the water of death in her hands. She is now in what should be a familiar position. That is, to readers of classic mythology, right? She is exactly Jack Rabbit, like Orpheus, descending into the underworld to get Eurydice back. She is like Odysseus, going down to the underworld. She is like Hercules. Sorry, Heracles, I suppose, since we're being Greek. She is like Heracles going down into the underworld for his tasks, right? She is like Theseus, except hopefully doesn't end like him. There are a number of Greek myths that involve the descent into the underworld of the central hero figure. Maureen, like Persephone in some ways, though Persephone's descent into the underworld was involuntary, right? Persephone was raped. That is, raptus. She was kidnapped, right? She was grabbed by... I almost called him Pluto, which is wrong. Hades, right? She was grabbed by Hades and brought down into the underworld. So it is true that Persephone was another, and importantly, a female figure who is brought down into underworld. And by the way, that's the Queen of the Deadlands, right? She's connected to Persephone there. But yes, in the original myth, she's bringing the casket to Persephone. Yes, 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 exactly. Exactly. Yes. So remember that we just had the recollection of the scene in Homer, right? Remember that wonderful exchange that I couldn't read without crying when the fox catches Orwell as she's falling off the pedestal where she was just accusing the gods, and she expresses her amazement, right? You know, grandfather, I thought, you know, Homer said that the dead are shades, that the dead and the living can't interact. And you remember the fox saying, I was right about one thing, right? That was one of the things I was right about. The poets are often wrong. So she has already recalled to us the Odysseus, like, speaking to the dead, encountering the dead scene in the Odyssey, right? So the descent, so let's go back for a second, Jackrabbit, to Orpheus, because that's, I think, another very important one here. Brief summary for those of you who don't have the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice at the tips of your fingers. Orpheus was the greatest human musician, and was such a wonderful musician that all of, like, nature, like the rivers would stop running, the animals would gather around, everything would sort of stand in rapt attention around him when he was playing his harp. And he marries a young woman, Eurydice, whom he loves very much, and she is killed on their wedding day. She is struck by a serpent and dies. And Orpheus is completely devastated by the loss of Eurydice, so he descends to he finds the entrance to the underworld, descends into the underworld, and, stop me if you've heard this before, sings a song before the gods of the dead of such power that for the first time in all recorded history, the gods of death relent, and they decide to have mercy and to let the dead mortal return to the world. Doesn't ring a bell for you, Jackie? I know it's a strange kind of story that might strike everybody as a little bit weird. But of course, in the Greek version, there is a very important catch to this. He is told that that Eurydice, his wife, he can lead his wife out, but he cannot look back at her until they get up to the top. So he has to lead her out, trusting that she is behind him and trusting that everything is okay, until they get back to the mortal world again. They get out of the underworld. And Orpheus leads Eurydice up out of the underworld, and they get almost all the way out. And then, like, thinking she might have stumbled, he turns and looks back for just a second, and he sees Eurydice behind him, and just as he sees her, as they're about to leave and be reunited forever, she's taken away. She fades in front of his eyes and is drawn back down to the underworld, and he can't. He is not reunited with her, and then eventually is ripped into pieces later on. But anyway, yes. Several of you are remembering Lot's wife. Yes, no. There's a lot of deep mythic connection going on here. Yeah. Kind of like Psyche not being able to talk on her journeys. Yep, Hapuna, exactly right. That you'll see some of the similarities here in this story as well. Yes. Yeah. Anyway. So. Yeah. Lots of connections. Lots and lots, Eric, exactly. So those of you who are watching this asynchronously should be glad that you can't see all of the Lot's wife puns that are currently being made in the chat right now. But in any case, it's important to keep that in mind. So, Jackrabbit, you were saying you were feeling like there seems clearly to be some kind of resonance between Psyche's story and Orpheus's story. Let's think about that, because I agree with you. I think that those are the two primaries. Theseus kind of goes to the underworld like on a dare. It doesn't end well for a while. Anyway. Heracles goes to the underworld to, capture their guard dog and bring it up for one of his labors. But I do think that the two stories that are the three stories that are importantly resonant with this is first the one that the text had reminded us of, Odysseus interacting with the shades of the dead. We already got that connection. Secondly, the Orpheus myth, for sure. And the third is the Persephone myth, who's involved here. Persephone, who herself came down to the... And so, by the way, just very briefly, the myth of Persephone. Persephone, she's a goddess. She's not a mortal, exactly. But, though different versions of the story differ. But in any case, Persephone is... Hades, the god of the underworld, falls in love with her, and he does what Greek gods do, which is go up and snatch her and bring her down by force. And she is trapped in the underworld. Her mom spends a long time trying to find her and is real upset. Finally, there's this sort of deal struck. Persephone knows that if she eats any food in the underworld, that she won't be able to return to the world above. And in the end, she eats 4 pomegranate seeds. And because she ate the 4 pomegranate seeds, her mom, Demeter, and Hades kind of work out a timeshare. And Persephone gets to go back up to the overworld for part of the year, but because she ate the 4 pomegranate seeds, she has to go back every year to the underworld. So in the myth, this is connected with the turn of the seasons. This is why winter happens, because her mom is the Demeter is the goddess of the harvest, the goddess of the crops. And so she's in mourning when her daughter is away, and so winter happens, and then her daughter returns. Persephone is associated with spring for this reason. Her return is spring and the return of life into the land and the returned joy of Demeter. And then she goes into mourning in anticipation, and then, it gets to be winter again every year. That's the other myth that we should be remembering, because she becomes when she's, down there, which she seems to be in almost every other myth you read. She's the queen of the deadlands, right? She is the queen of the dead. Well, golly, Liz, you are completely correct about that. Liz says, when Orwell pitched an absolute fit about losing her daughter to the god, it didn't go as well as it did for Demeter. No, but that is very, very well remembered. I do think that that's another very relevant parallel here, right? Orwell did believe herself to be in the Demeter position, basically, right, in that story. She wasn't. Actually, right? I think it's a kind of like a twisted version of that, right? In some ways. But of course, it's also, Liz, it also maps just straight onto the Cupid and Psyche part, right? Why was it really, at the end of the day, why was Orwell so upset? What was in her book? That is the book she actually read at the trial, right? Her real voice, her real words, her real heart there. It was jealousy, right? And jealousy is what activates Aphrodite in the Cupid and Psyche story. The Eros and Psyche story. Sorry, I should be consistent with using Greek names if we're going to use them. And Aphrodite is Ungot, right? And it's been some time now since Orwell figured out that she is Ungot. And so that is a parallel that's already been established. But I agree, Liz, I do think that it's important to remember to sort of overlay that with the Demeter Persephone thing. There's a kind of similarity there. It's not the same, right? But it's that issue of divine jealousy. We can see that in both of those stories with, you know, Demeter. Again, I'm not saying it's inappropriate for her to be upset about her daughter being, you know, hauled off to be married against her will. But anyway, that we see the her desire to keep her daughter, and Aphrodite's envy and jealousy of Psyche in the Cupid and Psyche myth. Sorry, Eros and Psyche myth. One way to think about this. So, sorry, Liz, I'm kind of thinking through the Demeter parallel that you're suggesting, which I find very interesting. You know, one way that I would kind of think about it, is Orawal felt herself to be in the Demeter slot, right? She felt that it was that kind, that like, basically she was in the wrong myth. She didn't realize it, right? She felt like she was Demeter in the Persephone myth, when actually she was Aphrodite in the Eros and Psyche myth. Both cases, a maternal figure who is, you know, wanting to hold on to, right, the sibling, where there's sort of jealousy there. But Orawal, again, she was in the wrong myth. Ambrosius says Demeter's fit was her throwing a fit was genuine motherly love, but Orawal is too full of jealousy, envy, and self-loathing. Yeah, pretty much. Again, she convinced herself that she was playing the Demeter role in some ways. Right? Again, not literally, not exactly. You know what I mean? Like, she's like, I'm getting the fact that I'm paralleling a myth, but she had the wrong one. And Liz, exactly. The difference in Psyche is the huge difference, right? Demeter was glad to be rescued, it seemed, right? But Psyche was, and again, just think of how the Demeter, the rape myth was overlaid even earlier. We didn't talk about this at the time, right? But she believed that, as Orawal was convincing herself, remember the fox's theory, that some criminal or someone had raped or seduced or deceived Psyche, right? And made her his harlot or concubine or whatever, right? And she was trying to rescue her daughter, right, from the clutches of this foul so-called husband, right? There's definitely an overlay of the Persephone myth, especially, you know, with the crossing of the boundary and stuff. It's not overworld, underworld, you know, that we were seeing up on the mountain and stuff. But again, that boundary, it does. It's a similarly significant boundary there. But yes, Jackie, exactly right. Her effort to rescue Psyche, who was in fact blissfully happy, possibly might have been a clue that she had the myth wrong. But exactly as Hapuna says, it's the underlying jealousy that activated that, which we could see even back at the time when we were reading book one, and which of course comes out so clearly in her final accusation against the gods. But you're exactly right, Mrs. Manrique, that because Orawal thought Psyche's choice was manipulated, or you know, she was deceived, therefore her marriage was equivalent to a rape. Yeah, no, that's the language that both the fox and Orawal were using. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. So anyway, point is, that is very definitely another relevant mythic structure here. So back to, again, what we're seeing here on the wall, right? Psyche walking alone in a wide way under the earth, a gentle slope, but downwards, always downwards. The descent of Psyche. Psyche descending, not like the fox descended, not in the rather peculiar way that Orawal has descended, dying before she died. Maybe Psyche is also dying before she dies. We don't really know that for sure. This is not really Psyche's story. But she is descending, walking down a slope from the overworld, like a hero, like Odysseus, like Orpheus, descending on her own feet, of her own will, down into the land of the dead, crossing that boundary. And that's where it starts. Jackie says it reminds her of Orawal falling from pillar room to pillar room, far below the earth. Notice, Jackie, that twice Orawal has descended. Once there, in the vision of the pillar room, under the pillar room, under the pillar room, and once in her trial, well, not her trial, the trial of the gods, right, where she was the plaintiff. Her trial in that sense, I guess. She, both times, you'll remember, interestingly, she doesn't, this is exactly what she does not do, right? Walking downwards, always downwards, right? Remember how she gets down into the inner pillar rooms, right? Her father chucks her against her will. Like, she's like, please don't, no, right? Gets chucked down into the next pillar room, and then they dig again and build and dig another hole, and then he throws her down again, right? She doesn't want to go. She has to get pushed down each hole until she finally confronts the reality, right? That the mirror, that's, and of course you'll remember the result of that. It's her recognition. I am Unget, right? The second time, she is, remember, she's crowd surfing, right? She's hauled hand over hand by the hands of all the shades, and brought down, in a sense, not wholly against her will, right? In the sense that she wanted to go there. We were looking before at how the shades, it's almost as if the serpents and scorpions turned into the shades, right? And bring her down. How she felt, how helpless she felt, that she could not possibly climb the mountain and get into, you know, the inner place where she was supposed to go. Which, remember, that's exactly where Psyche is, right? This is right after their parallel trips across the desert and stuff have parted. Orawal knows the task, which, when she still believes her task is to take the bowl and get the water of death, she's like, I've got to get in that hole so I can get down, right? She believes she's going to take this trip, walking down the wide way, downwards, always downwards. That it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work out that way, I should say. She is hauled in not by her own power, because she can't. She knows she can't. And Psyche is brought in by her own power too, but instead of being pulled down by the hands of the shades, she is swept up by the eagle of the gods. And now she's walking down. Walking down. And it is a gentle slope, Maureen, and I think that's important. As Mrs. Manrique says, it's easy, right? This is not she's not watching Psyche on an arduous walk, right? Just as Psyche has been in all of her tasks, she's assigned these three theoretically impossible tasks, and not only has she been achieving them all, have we been seeing her in these pictures achieving them all, she's done so without suffering, even without effort, right? And so I agree. I think that the gentleness of the slope here, I think that's the really important, that's the really important thing here. And yes, Mighty Felix, Psyche doesn't have to jump into any pits. Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's hold off. Hang on. Yeah, I don't want to talk about the not speaking yet. We'll get there. But first, let's go back to... No, we're not going to get to the next slide quite yet, Mrs. Manrique. But notice that there's a very important interruption here. That is, the fox is explaining. Of course, the fox has to explain because this is the only part of the pictures on the wall that Orwell has not herself experienced, right? Oh, we'll get there. We'll get there with Fanrig, don't worry. But first, the interruption. Then there is a real Ungot? She asks, right? She's surprised. This is the list of tasks that Ungot has set her. Then there is a real Ungot, right? Why is she surprised? Why she's seen, she knows the gods are real. She's interacted with one a couple times now, right? She was just in that trial of the gods and feels that her accusations were answered, right? What does it mean that she was surprised? What does it mean that she was surprised to find that Ungot's real? I think, again, this goes back to... I think this goes back to two things. First of all, don't forget this, it's the connection with her, right? Let's not forget that, for one thing. But secondly, back to that scene that we got in the previous chapter when she was there at the festival in the House of Ungot, right? And even after she had... even after she'd learned what she'd learned, right, and been shown what she had shown, she'd been shown and all that stuff, she was having a really hard time with the House of Ungot. Leif, I think that's exactly right. She's both processed her identification with Ungot as well as the sham of the Ungot religion. Yeah. Yeah. Now, so you remember that there was one of the insights that she had during that ceremony was that there seems to be something real in it, right? The old peasant woman really received comfort. The community was really brought together by this totally symbolic and ceremonial act, this sort of fake act, this play acting, right, that was being done. There was something real in it, but at the same time, she's looking around her, and she's in no doubt of the fact that what surrounds her is horrible. These poor temple prostitutes and what has been done to them and their lives. What has been all the animals and even people that have been sacrificed on this rock. All the waste and everything. The even just the smell and the sickeningness, right, of this dark and horrible place. So both of those things at once, both like there is something real here, but also yikes, right? This can't be what it really is. I think that's why she says, then there is a real Ungot. She's like, I thought Ungot was just an idea, right? And of course, a terrible idea from her point of view. Right, she identified with Ungot. I am Ungot. But when she said, I am Ungot, to Orwell, saying I am Ungot did not mean, so, turns out my dad was right about us being of divine lineage. Right? In fact, I am a goddess. I am Ungot herself. No, that's not what she was saying. At all, right? She was sort of taking the idea of Ungot and she's saying, well, like, for all that I have hated Ungot and hated the idea of the worship of Ungot and everything my whole life, that's actually a picture of me, right? But that didn't mean that she believed that all of that stuff was real or like correct, right? It must be. Yeah, she doesn't want to be the Ungot she knows from the ceremonies, Hapuna. Exactly. And that's what she acknowledges, right? Yeah, I am that. I am that ugly, bloated, blood-stained thing, which is battening on the lives and blood and seed and money of men, right? sucking them dry, like the spider at the beginning of the web. And but that doesn't mean that she accepts the myths of Unget as literal truth, right? That she believes that that rock really is a goddess named Unget, right? It's that, I think, is the shock for her here. She's like, wait, time out. There's a real Unget. Unget's, it's all true. And then the fox explains, and let's do his explanation a little carefully here. All, even Psyche, are born into the house of Unget, and all must get free from her, or say that Unget in each must bear Unget's son and die in childbed, or change. And now Psyche must go down into the deadlands. So hang on, let's just, those first three sentences are enough to be going on with for now. Okay. All, even Psyche, are born into the house of Unget, and all must get free from her, or say that Unget in each must bear Unget's son and die in childbed, or change. Die or change. No other options leave. Yeah. All are born into the house of Unget, and all must get free from her. Do you see what that means? All are born into the house of Unget, and all must get free. If everyone's born into the house of Unget, what does that make? If we're all born into the house of Unget, what does that make us? What does it make us? Who are we, then? Well, yeah, children of Unget, who is the god. Yeah, Ambrosius, that's what I was thinking. Unget's girls. Y'all are thinking all these flattering thoughts. I'm thinking we're all temple prostitutes. What's the point of the temple prostitutes? Let's go back to the temple prostitutes. Please don't take that sentence out of context. Always have to be careful what you say on the internet, don't you? What do we... And Frosch says, new TikTok, dropping tonight. So, anyhow, you've got the mask. None, they don't have faces. Instead, they have the painted wooden mask face, right? Which is this painted, gilded image of beauty, of feminine beauty, right? It's this, yeah, literally a wooden, a sort of a supposed, it's supposed to invoke anyway, beauty, right? The symbols of fertility, Unget deigns to grant the world, yes. That's what the golden paps are about, right? Yes. One of the primary reasons I'm connecting this when he says we're born into the house of Unget and all must get free from her. Unget's girls were the ones who were most like enslaved. Those are the ones, when she was just there in the house of Unget, when Orowal was just there during the ceremony in that scene we were just referring to, it was Unget's girls that she was looking at. They're the residents of, they're the ones who live in the house of Unget. Are Unget's girls, the temple prostitutes, and so yeah, if there is anyone, if the actual house of Unget that Orowal has seen in Gloam is a picture of what the fox is here describing, the ones who are born into the house of Unget and must get free from her sound to me like Ungit's girls, especially since Ungit they, again, there's the need to get free, but there's also the way in which they are connected to her, right? So the way that he transitions immediately from born in the house of Ungit, need to get free, to the Ungit in each, right? And the prostitutes are themselves a representative of Ungit, right? They stand in for Ungit. That's why there are temple prostitutes. It's a fertility ritual, right? The men have sex with the temple prostitutes, and that is a ritual sign of the sowing of the seed in the fields, right? Of the fertility of the land, right? That's what it's about. They are part of the enacted ritual of fertility. And in that enacted ritual of fertility, they play the role of Ungit, right? So, guys in the chat, please help me tonight. This could be the last class, okay? This is difficult. I need your help tonight. So please. I need you to focus with me and help me in tonight's class. So he shifts from the one thing. We are all born into the house of Ungit and all must get free of her. All must get free of her. Not like realize the truth about Ungit, that we were wrong all along, or that kind of thing. That he... everyone must get free of Ungit. Ungit is a problem. Ungit is a serious problem. Ungit is slavery. You have to get free. You have to die to Ungit, right? Or no, not dying to Ungit. We all are Ungit. Ungit in each must bear Ungit's son and die in childbed or change. Ungit's son, now that's the god of the mountain, whom Orwell has encountered on a couple of occasions, right? Yeah, die before we die. This is Ungit in each. Yeah, JJ, Ungit is sounding a bit like sin in Christianity. Yes, in some ways. Though, of course, notice that is also a quasi-allegorical abstraction. I mean, in the New Testament, that's a quasi-allegorical abstraction. Loving the detailed Tanakh discussion that's going on there with Hosea and Ezekiel. Not going to go there just because it's too much. I don't have time to talk about those passages in detail, and it wouldn't help many other people for me to talk about them without doing that, so I'm going to skip them. Not tonight. Judy, no, we don't seem to get to be Ungit's son. We must bear Ungit's son. We must bear Ungit's son and die in childbed. Remember when remember when we were looking at the first wall, and Orawal says, "Do not do it, do not do it." And Psyche seems to hear her, just exactly like Orawal herself heard the voice of the god, the voice that cannot be mistaken for a mortal voice, saying exactly those words. This, the way in which Orawal and the god of the mountain were being overlaid with each other in that sense, in that scene, right? Maureen is reminding us that Psyche's mother died in childbed. Yes, she did, didn't she? Yes. Anyway, okay, right. So we've seen a connection between Orawal and the god of the mountain, right? Should we be thinking of the childbirth imagery that's already come up for Orawal earlier in the book, Yarrow? Yeah, we should. Yeah, we should. And remember what she did earlier on. The queen, right? Remember, it was the queen who was... There were kind of two childbirth images that we got. One was her claim of Psyche as her daughter, even though, like, despite the fact that she didn't give birth to her, and, like, which she acknowledged, but she was, like, you know, not wanting to think about. The other... The other was, yes, Yarrow, exactly, the king, the queen being unpregnant with Orawal. Orawal being pregnant with her book, and the queen being imprisoning Orawal in her womb so that Orawal would shrink and die, being bricked up inside the sterile womb of the queen, like the queen had bricked up the well whose swinging chains sounded like so much like the weeping of Psyche, right? Notice how the queen is Unget there too, and how Orawal had to get free of the house of Unget, of the prison, right, that she was in the womb of the queen, right? And how do you do that? Being born, back to that ritual that several of you were recalling before, right? The ritual where the priest of Unget goes and beats on the door and fights his way out. He is born, right? So it's Sorawal being born. That's like getting free, right? So it's like her birth. It's also like giving birth, right? She is like the child. She is also like the mother. But what she must bear is not her own child, but to bear Unget's son, to bear the god of the mountain. Remember her book. The book that she actually read, I mean. The book she read in her trial. About how resentful. Do you think... Remember how it started, I think? If I'm recalling correctly? Do you think it would make it better? If we knew the gods were beautiful, it wouldn't make it better, it would make it worse, right? Remember her resentful words about the beauty and power of the gods that she's seen in when she met Unget's son, right? And again, think about how that jealousy and anger was all tangled up with the god of the mountain and with Psyche, right? Yeah, Orawal was pregnant with her book, but she also... Right, she was with book, as JJ recalls. Yes, it was that book that she gave birth to instead, right? That won't do it. In the end, there was no way there for her to stop being Unget. She would have, when she gave birth to her book, right, when that moment of birth came in the trial, when she finally opened the book and spoke out those things, she was caught in this never-ending loop, right? And yeah, Hapuna, I think you can see it did, in a sense, consume her, right? You must die in childbed or change. more on this, Fox. And now Psyche must go down into the Deadlands to get beauty in a casket from the Queen of the Deadlands, from Death herself. And this seems like an alternate. She was getting the water of death to bring in the bowl and bring that back to Unget. And now she's getting beauty in a casket from death to bring it back to Unget, right? Those two things, the beauty and the death, the waters of death and the beauty in a casket, right? Those two things are being placed into parallel here. What's the third thing placed in that parallel? You've got the casket, the beauty in a casket, which is parallel to the bowl full of the waters of death, which is parallel to her book. Yeah, her book. What she thought she was carrying a bowl, but it turned out to be the book, right? In place of the waters of death, she had her book full of poison, right? In place of the waters of death, which is like the casket full of beauty, which does in fact make, we will in fact make Unget beautiful, just like the golden fleece that will give beauty. Yeah, Devorah, exactly. In place of those things, Orwell had her book full of poison. Not waters of death, but poison. And that, instead of giving beauty to Unget, that took the final veil away from Orwell's own face, right? So that her own ugliness, inner ugliness, is fully and finally revealed to herself and the gods and everybody, right? She wasn't exactly made ugly by it, but again, the final covering, the covering that she had always placed over it, so that even quite recently in book two, she was able to say, but thank goodness I had always loved Psyche well, right? Yes, exactly, Corey, we had her veil ripped off and her clothes stripped away and she's standing there naked, right? Literally showing what was sort of spiritually happening to her as well. And so there, revealed on the podium, is her ugly, shriveled body, right? Which was always ugly on the best of days, right? And as she has described in fairly colorful language, hadn't gotten any better to look at in her old age, right? But there's also the question of ugliness and beauty of soul, as she had been thinking about lately, right? And the poison in her book is what reveals the true ugliness of her soul. So again, just notice a reversal of that, right? Water of the bowl of the waters of death, which is like beauty in a casket. The waters of death becoming beauty. You have to go through the waters. Waters of death. The bowl of the waters of death. This is like every river boundary we've seen in the text, right? Just like the waters of death, the river of death that she waded out into up to her, you know, up to her knees, up to her belly, up to her neck, right? She had to pass through the waters of death. And remember what she was trying to get to on the other side when she did pass through those waters of death. The garden of the gods, where she could get beauty for herself in those golden fleeces from the rams, right? So the waters of death, beauty in a casket. But remember, the beauty in the casket is not for the holder. It's for somebody else, right? It's for Unget. It'll make Unget beautiful so that Unget will become beautiful. So Psyche's casket containing beauty, which will make Unget beautiful. And this is why this is the final task, right? By succeeding in this task, she is going to transform Unget herself. Unget has been her enemy to this point, right? Unget has been her enemy, Psyche's enemy, right? Serious mother-in-law issues in the myth of Cupid and Eros, right? serious mother-in-law issues. Ungit has been her primary enemy. Ungit is jealous of her. Ungit won't let her be married to her, to the god of the mountain, to her son, right? So one, the first thing that we have seen is that this is yet another way, right, in which Orawal is Ungit and her jealousy for Psyche so baldly revealed in her book full of poison that she read. Yeah, Psyche is indeed caught between two devouring mothers. Yeah, exactly. Except, yeah, it's kind of not two, right? They're kind of the same. And so again, this is where I come back to this language that the fox is using at the beginning here, the Ungit in each, right? This is Orawal's story, but in a sense, this is not uniquely Orawal's story. And there is a brief hope, I think, a brief hope that maybe there is a way for an ugly soul to become a beautiful soul, as Orawal herself had hoped, if Ungit can be made beautiful by the casket of beauty that's given to her. The casket of beauty brought back from the Deadlands. Then maybe there is some hope. But this is the law of her journey. If for any fear or favor or love or pity she speaks to anyone on the way, then she will never come back to the sunlit lands again. She must keep straight on in silence till she stands before the throne of the Queen of Shadows. All's at stake. She is descending before down to the throne of the goddess of death, of the Queen of Shadows, and she can't speak to anyone. Mrs. Banrick, you're absolutely right to think here of the connection between the masks of Ungit's girls and the veil of Orwell, right? Okay. Notice, by the way, Jackrabbit. This comes back to back to Orpheus, right? You see the parallels? Just as Orpheus couldn't look around to see Eurydice behind him, so she also, Psyche also, cannot turn aside from her path. She must continue resolutely on her path. With this case, it's not explicitly like looking back, right? But the similarity is there. The similarity of you must stay perfectly resolutely on your journey without turning to one side or the other. And here, the dynamic, right? The temptation is to turn aside for the people, to speak to someone. If for any fear or favor or love or pity, any reason, she has to disregard all the people. Why would she not be able to turn to someone in love? What's wrong with love? When is love a problem? Well, when the loving and the devouring are one, things can get kind of sketchy, can't they? Yeah, we've seen love go very wrong already, Mighty Felix. Absolutely. Absolutely. JJ, so usually when you guys quote, like, things from Lewis's other books, I don't read them out because I don't want to go there and overcomplicate things. But that one is really too good, and I think it's really... I would just point to it. We don't have to talk about it, but I would just point to it as one of the really fun things about this book. There are a bunch of ways in which... I mean, I was joking before that if all we had were Till We Had Faces, we could probably recreate reconstruct most of the rest of Lewis's works. But there's another way in which when you really read and think about Till We Have Faces, it will like retroactively transform a whole bunch of Lewis's other books. And so just the quote from The Silver Chair, "Many fall down and few return to the sunlit land," said the voice. "Make ready now to come with me to the queen of the deep realm." Yes, you never quite look at that passage in the same way after you read Till We Have Faces. Yeah. Curious Chance, when I was a kid, The Silver Chair was my least favorite of the Narnia books, but I changed over time. I quite like it. Now, still, Horse and His Boy has always been my favorite and always will be, but I have certainly come to like The Silver Chair much, much more. I learned the error of my ways. Absolutely. I like Jack Rabbit's parody of the end of The Breakfast Club. "But what we found out is that each one of us is a devouring mother and a princess and a prostitute and a queen and a philosopher and a god of the mountain." Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Okay. All's at stake. Now watch. Let's keep going. So instead of finishing the whole book tonight, how about we get through more than one slide? How does that sound? Okay. He needed not to tell me that. We both watched. Psyche went on and on, deeper into the earth, colder, deeper, darker. But at last there came a chilly light on one side of her way, and there, I think, the great tunnel or gallery in which she journeyed opened out. For there, in that cold light, stood a great crowd of people. A great crowd of rabble, sorry. Their speech and clothes showed me at once that they were people of Gloam. I saw the faces of some I knew. "Istra, Princess, Ungit," they called out, stretching their hands towards her. "Stay with us, be our goddess, rule us, speak oracles to us, receive our sacrifices, be our goddess." Psyche walked on and never looked at them. "Whoever the enemy is," said I, "he's not very clever if he thinks she will falter for that." "Wait," said the fox. Yes, Ambrosius, marvelous observation. Ambrosius points out immediately, this is one expression of love. The first temptation that we see is an expression of love, the people's adoration. Right, the people did love her. That is, when they weren't executing her, but they did love her. Right, this is a thing that happened. This is a kind of love that she was shown. As Orawal, I love. You know, so we're gonna get all three of the temptations, right? And we'll get like Statler and Waldorf commentary from Orawal and the Fox, right, on the temptations as they come. Her comment on this, she's rather derisive of this. "Oh, please, this is easy. This is an easy temptation to overcome. She's not going to give in to that." Right? And no, she doesn't. She walks on, and she never looks at them. A Curious Chance, it's a really good point. The people love Orawal, too. And I think it's important for us to remember. We have already had lots and lots and lots of reminders, right, that not only is Orawal Ungit, as she has very painfully discovered, but she also shall be Psyche, right? And so, yes, inasmuch as this does not seem like a strong temptation to Psyche, right, to Istra, something kind of like this also is a temptation to the queen, to Orawal. She was never super tempted by this. Right, her head has rarely been turned by the adulation of the people. Think of the tone with which she speaks, even of the like legends and myths of her doings. Right. She speaks quite slightingly of the people and of their adulation even then. Why? Because she remembers this. She remembers the people. She has never forgiven the people of Gloam for turning on Psyche, right? For worshiping her first, while Psyche went out and took their filthy diseases on herself, remember? And then after that, they turned on her, right? And demanded her death and her sacrifice. Now, you're right, Ambrosius. She doesn't want to be worshipped by the people. She doesn't really seem to care for their love, but she did somewhat encourage their mythologizing of her. She found it convenient. Yeah, remember her veil, right? It boosts her mystique. It was definitely useful to her for that. Yeah. And you're right, Mrs. Manrique. Psyche cares so much more for the people. Orwell was always derisive towards them. Yes, you're right. Psyche did love them. Yeah. Yes. Now, Liz, that's really wonderful. Liz says, everything that made Psyche good, her willingness to go out to the people and to respond to them and so on, is exactly what she's being asked to reject. Yeah, or to resist. So, it's tricky. All three of these are going to be tricky, right? These temptations, these final temptations here, these three final temptations. Because none of them are, like, evil. Well, no. Let me say this the other way around. Psyche's response to these people, there's nothing wrong with it, right? Liz, going back to what you were saying, Psyche's generosity to the people, there was nothing wrong with that. I don't see any evidence that that's a sin she has to repent of, you know. I don't think that's what this temptation is about. Now, there's a difference, though. What they are doing and saying is not right. It would be wrong to accept this on these grounds. To love the people, to care for the people, to be generous to the people is not wrong. To hear them say, Istra, Ungit, stay with us, be our goddess, rule us, speak oracles to us, receive our sacrifices, be our goddess. And to say, okay, that would be wrong. Right? The response, as we were observing from the beginning of this temptation here, the foundation of it is love. Right? And yet, it is on their part, through what they're saying here, it's a love twisted. They can love her. They can even, in some sense, revere her. But that's out of whack. And her accepting it would be even more out of whack, right? But even if she could, but the temptation is not respond appropriately, right? The test is don't respond. Don't respond to it at all. Don't turn aside from your path. You have a mission, and your mission is to bring your empty bowl and get the waters of death in it. It's to bring your casket and get it filled full of beauty so that you can take that beauty to Ungit. That's your task. To seek the Queen of Shadows. Doesn't that sound like Orwell too? Anyway, seek the Queen of Shadows. And don't be turned aside from that by anything. Maureen says, kind of like me trying to get through my slides when you guys are making puns and distracting me. So true. I was so failing at my task earlier tonight. Yeah, exactly. Curious Chance was saying, it's not necessarily that the action is evil in itself. It's that the law of her journey forbids it. Yes. Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that law here is supposed to point to something. It is a symbolic prohibition, right? Not unlike the comparison that you make to the eating of the forbidden fruit, right? Again, it's not that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is poisonous or something, right? The action is a pointer to something else, right? It's a rule that's placed there for a reason, right? And this rule is placed there for a similar kind of reason, in a sense. Yeah. So, Liz, I think you are not wrong. Liz says, I think there's something here about faith or service of God requiring sometimes that you walk away from the even reasonable demands that are being put on you by others. Yes, I agree. I think that that is, in fact, one of the things that's happening here. And Liz, the best thing to do here, I think, is to watch the trajectory. Right? Don't take each one of these on their own, but look at the overall pattern that all three temptations form. And that, I think, will help us to understand better. Because, again, it would be more puzzling in the direction... So if I'm appreciating properly, Liz, the direction that you're thinking, the sort of uncertainties or concerns that you have about what Lewis seems to be saying about faith here. If I understand that correctly, I would point out that notice that the thing to be resisted, the thing that she must ignore and walk past, is not just a neutral expression of love. This is not just... Her way could simply be lined with the people whom she loved. If you think about it, the way could be lined with, like, the people whom she loved begging for her help, right? Like, oh, look, there's Orwell bleeding to death. Are you going to stop and help her, or are you just going to ignore her and keep walking and let her die, right? Like, that is a thing which would fit into the terms of this test, it would seem. But that's not what we see here. That's certainly not what we see. Again, we don't see, like, so for instance, here's the closest parallel I can think of with this one, this first temptation, right? It could have been the crowds of people during the plague, right? The same crowds, just as they came to the doors of the palace and beat on the doors of the palace and begged for Psyche to come out to them, right? But, like, this time she has to not go. She did, in her love and generosity and even self-sacrifice, the first time, right, when that actually happened. She went out to them. So Liz Lewis could have constructed this exactly that way, where what they're saying is exactly what they said at that point, right? Come out to us, heal us, heal us. Send out Istra, the princess, right, the healing hands. We die, we die. But that's not what they're saying. Instead, they are offering her love. They're expressing to her love, which is itself twisted. Again, it's good for them to love her. It's good for them to cherish and appreciate, even adore her in some ways, but not to be our goddess, receive our sacrifices, rule us, speak oracles to us. That's not okay, actually, right? That's twisted. So Liz, again, do you see the point I'm making? The love that she is put in a position where she has to reject here is in fact a twisted love. And Orwell thinks this is an easy one, right? And again, Liz, it's hard because I don't want to go too far in the opposite direction. I do think a part of what was being expressed in the poison book, right? What was being expressed in Orwell's book On the Stand, her accusation against the gods, was exactly an unwillingness, a recognition of the fact that Psyche was being called to a relationship with the god, and that she left Orwell and went, she chose the god instead of Orwell. She went to her, this husband of hers, and left her, Orwell, behind. And she resents it and doesn't forgive it. And she resents the god for making Psyche choose. And this kind of thing is going to happen all the time, right? You beautiful, perfect gods with all your perfect, loving godliness, right? How can we compete with that? Right? You're going to be pulling these people away from us all the time. So that there is competition. I mean, Orwell herself represents, she is the, like, instance, the embodiment almost of that kind of competition there. So I don't want to undermine your discomfort too much. There's something there's I don't think you're wrong in the thing that you're uncomfortable about, but I would say there is, he could have just pushed that discomfort straight in your face, and he's not done that. Again, their love is a twisted love. Hey, let's do at least one more. Psyche, her eyes fixed straight ahead, went further on and further down. And again, on the left side of her road, there came a light. One figure rose up in it. I was startled at this one and looked to my side. The fox was with me still, but he who rose up in the cold light to meet Psyche by the wayside was also the fox, but older, grayer, paler than the fox who was with me. Oh, Psyche, Psyche, said the fox in the picture. Say, in that other world, it was no painted thing. What folly is this? What are you doing wandering through a tunnel beneath the earth? What? You think it is the way to the Deadlands? You think the gods have sent you here? You think the gods have sent you there? All lies of priests and poets, child. It is only a cave or a disused mine. There are no Deadlands such as you dream of, and no such gods. Has all my teaching taught you no more than this? The god within you is the god you should obey. Reason, calmness, self-discipline. Fie, child, do you want to be a barbarian all your days? I would have given you a clear, Greek, full-grown soul. But there's still time. Come to me, and I'll lead you out of this darkness, back to the grass plot behind the pear trees, where all was clear, hard, limited, and simple. The fox's appeal is an appeal of love as well. Another show of love. His love for her, just as the crowd, the people, the rabble, to use Orwell's word, were showing love. We're showing love for her as well, right? Yeah, Leaf, it is kind of delightful that a shade in the Deadlands is arguing that there are no Deadlands, right? Yeah, yeah. And yeah, don't worry, Ambrosius. I think we're no longer in much. Having spent like an hour on the first slide, I don't think we're in much danger of finishing tonight. So yes, Maureen, which is the shade, right? Notice the contrast, right? I mean, our attention is drawn to this. Orwell looks over at the fox who's standing next to her, right? Because she is worried that, like, the fox has been sucked into the, like, that he's gone, that he's there, right? The pictures are no longer pictures. She, Orwell, rejects that idea. Don't say in the painting. It's no painted thing, right? Say in that other world. She is seeing something that is happening. Again, time, very unclear here. Right. Is it happening right now? What does that even mean? Right. That, I think, doesn't matter. Yeah, time and dimension both are a little bit meaningless, Maureen. I agree. But notice the other thing that is emphasized. When she looks back and forth between them, Orwell, right? The fox who's at her side, the shade of the fox, and the fox that's in the other world with Psyche in the painting. The one that's lying in wait for Psyche is older, grayer, paler than the fox who is with her, right? It's like the fox that's with Psyche is a shade of the shade, right? A shadow of the shade, perhaps? Right, a limited shadow of the shade. Yara, we'll get back to that in a second. It's a facet of the fox. Yes. Yes, Jackrabbit, I love... We don't get the fox responding to himself here. But we've heard... Yeah, and the shade is younger. Yes. Older, grayer, paler, weaker, right? More faded. The fox who is with her is lively and strong and young, right? This is the full fox, the real fox, right? Not just this shadow of a fox, right? Liz says, are we supposed to be thinking of the allegory of the cave? You know, remember who's the intended audience? Who's the intended audience of this book? Greeks. Exactly, Ambrosius. Greeks, right? So yeah, I mean, we're going to be thinking about it, right? I mean, how can we not be thinking about it? I'm not going to go into it too much other than just to say it's not the real fox. It's a shadow of the fox, right? It is a reflection of the fox. It is a partial reflection of the... It's a parody of the fox, in a sense, right? But to me, the most important kind of platonic element of this moment, right, with the two foxes, is that the fox who is standing by Orawal as she looks at the wall, she looks at the painting on the wall, is like the real fox, the true fox. In a sense, the fox of which even his living self was only a shadow, right? The fox now knows the truth, right? The fox now knows and has already spoken. So we don't see him react to this, to his embarrassment, which he may well feel, right? Seeing his own, you know, like the words that he might have said repeated to Psyche and like weaponized against Psyche in this sort of way, right? I'm sure he did feel embarrassed, but remember how he responded before, right? Remember how lovingly and even laughingly he spoke of his own folly and the limitations of his own thinking. And at the time, anyone who is getting impatient with how long we're spending on this book will marvel to hear me say that we covered it too quickly and forgot to say something, but notice how painless, remember I should say, how painless and easy it was for the fox to confess what he was truly saying, right? For the fox to see through his own masks, to see beneath his own veils, the veils that he still wore, right? The veils of what he would now call his, you know, his folly and his fear and all of those. Remember the reasons that he was giving for why he used to say the things that he said and why he didn't go in, for how he couldn't admit that he didn't know and all of these things, right? Yeah, Yeah, so, and a lot of that, no, the thing that I'm saying we didn't notice at the time is how like that was to Orwell's book, but how different in tone, right? The kind of self-awareness that Orwell purchases very painfully through that experience of reading out her accusation against the gods, which is its own answer, right? The fox has also had that experience of learning. He has also achieved that same kind of self-awareness. The fox has looked himself in the mirror. The fox has stood without veil. And that real fox, the less old gray and pale fox that she has at her side, is the real fox, right? The real fox has been, just as the real Orwell was stripped and revealed, the real fox has been revealed, right? Yes, the one fox is at Orwell's side and the other is opposite her, is opposing Psyche. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Liz, I agree. Liz says, I'm trying to think of a worse experience for a parent figure than watching how the words you said with the best of intentions go on to wound your child. Oh, man. Liz, I don't know how old your kids are, but it's one of the hardest things about having adult kids, in my experience. You get to, when your kids become adults, you get to start being friends with them. But, man, you learn some things and you see some things then, which are hard. Are hard. 8 and 3, you got some time. Don't worry, Liz. A painful experience awaits you, but not for a while. You got time. You've got time. Yeah. Sorry. That's good. No, seriously. It'll be, I don't know. You got 15, 20 years. 15, 20 years to before you have to have that experience. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. Leaf, I think that's exactly right. This is Orwell's story, right? The fox, Psyche, the king, Bata, all must go under the knife. That is, you know, the knife of the divine surgeons, and die before they die. Yeah. Yeah. We don't see the fox's process, though I think we are seeing the result of the process, right? The fox, again, and that's where I think it's so important, though again, I didn't draw attention to it at the time, the difference in tone, right? How utterly at peace he is with even the mistakes that he made, with his own self-awareness, right? So yeah, Liz, you see, you were saying before, you could see the twisted love thing, right? The fox would have said this to her, to Psyche, out of love, right? Just as the people would have said, you know, let us worship you, out of love. But it's a twisted love. So why? What does that mean? What does that show us? How are we to interpret that? If, again, Liz, coming back to the same dynamic, which I'm so glad that you brought up, if it's not just a question of Psyche must choose her divine calling and not favor any other mortal love above it, right? That would be one way to construe these temptations. And as I said, that's not the picture that Lewis has given us, though it is an issue that is raised. That's not what we see in the temptations, right? Instead, what we see is what we see is the love of the people, the love for her of the people who were in her life, and how that love itself would lead her astray. How in the history of Psyche's own experience, the loving and the devouring have been one. What is being enacted here, almost reenacted here, this journey with the bowl slash casket in her hands is like a reenactment of her life and a glimpse into how the love of everyone who loved her would have drawn her away had she yielded to it. Not just because it was a secondary thing or a mortal thing and she should have kept her eyes on the divine instead of turning to mortal things, even good mortal things. That's not the emphasis here. The emphasis instead is on the fact that their love itself is of such a kind that it's going to pull her away. It's going to divert her. And why? Well, because all are born into the house of Unget, and all must get free from her. Or say that Unget and each must bear Unget's son and die in childbed or change. So, Liz, as I was saying before, I don't believe that Lewis is here denying the idea that even love for parents and friends and siblings and beloved teachers or whatever, right, like the fox, I don't think he's denying that those loves must be placed second, right, can't be allowed to get between Psyche and her divine mission and her divine calling. I don't think he's denying that. I think what he's doing is glossing that. He's giving us a commentary on that fact, given that why? I wasn't going to quote it, but I am. I saw a couple of people referring to it, and I was thinking at the time, I'm like, can I get away with not talking about that? Answer, no. Jesus talks about this a couple times. It's one of the most uncomfortable passages in the New Testament, I think, right? When Jesus says, anyone who does not hate his father or mother is not worthy of me. And it's like, dude, whoa, yeah, Luke 14, exactly. Or, as he says it, I believe in Matthew, anyone who loves mother or father more than me is not worthy of me. That sense of conflict. So, Liz, I think in the end, again, he's not saying that here. What he's doing is offering some commentary on it, right? Why? I think that one of the things he's doing here is answering the question, why did Jesus say that? Why? How can it be that that can be true? Many, many, many people have read those passages in Jesus' teaching and said, I don't get it. Why should I have to turn away from the love of my parents, right? And I think he's offering, So, Hapuna, I agree. I believe that Jesus is using hyperbole. Jesus uses hyperbole a lot. In fact, the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament have much in common with, like, you know, a shock jockey or something. Jesus is like way over the top in his expressions. Like, Jesus is a real attention grabber in how he phrases things. There's a trend throughout the Gospels. But shock value is what he seems to be going for a lot of the time, I think. So yes, is it hyperbole? Yeah, it is. But that doesn't mean you can't pay attention. You know, if you want to understand it, it doesn't mean he doesn't mean anything by it, right? Anyway, okay. So what does it mean? Again, I think that Lewis is here. One of the payoffs of what Lewis is doing here at the end is to help understand that idea. Why? Why is it that you can't, you know, in what sense? How could it be that the love of your parents could somehow be in conflict with your love for God? That doesn't make any sense. I think that Lewis is helping to make sense of that. How is it that the love of your parents can be, well, the love of your parents could be harmful to you if the loving and the devouring are one, right? And we are seeing in a simple and easy to see version with the love of the people in the first temptation, with a more painful version with the love of the fox in the second version, and of course in the most painful of all, in the third temptation, which we'll get to next time. All right, third temptation in the end. We'll save the third temptation for next time. So there we go. All right, that'll have to do for tonight. We'll get to the third temptation, and then who knows, perhaps we will see Psyche appear before the Queen of Shadows next time. All right, so unfortunately, for those who are following in real time, no class for the next 2 weeks, so we're going to leave it in suspense here between the second and third temptation for quite some time. It'll be May 1st when we come back again. How many slides do we get through this time, Liz? Like three. Yeah, it was three. Three slides. One, maybe two more classes. We'll see how it goes. All right. Thanks, everybody. I will see you in a few weeks, and we will continue towards the very, very end of the book. All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye now.